Well, welcome everyone to another edition of the NatCon Australia podcast, the bookish and based edition, where I chat with Jordan Knight, who's the founder of Migration Watch and also a director here at NatCon. How are you going, Jordan? Last time we spoke was just after the Trump election, and I was feeling very ebullient, and we were kind of expecting the waves to crash over here in Australia and for people to gradually, albeit slowly, you know, adjust their policy settings. Do you reckon there's been any evidence of any change in thinking since that time?
No, I think it's like exactly the opposite. I think like these people, like the regime, has like witnessed a threat, and so it's like solidified its position and is doubling down. It's the same in Europe as well. I mean, they're all sort of shifting and getting nervous, and they're worried about the same thing happening here. I mean, the only people I think of ever who are seeing the opportunity and seeing which way the wind is blowing, people like Matt Canavan, stuff like that. I mean, I think, you know, I noticed a bit of shift in his tone in the last few months. And I mean, he's always been good, but he's especially just sort of really tapping in. But what about you? Have you noticed anything?
Oh, no, it's just been, it's almost though the bomb went off and no one, and people are carrying on as normal. I mean, yeah. The classic example of just, you know, I don't know, I'm always in two minds about whether it's sort of complete cluelessness or whether there's actually a plan to resist, you know, the new changes or not. But that speech that Kim Williams gave, who's the chairman of the ABC and former CEO of News Limited as well, so he's deep in Australian media, was just an example where he basically, you know, described Joe Rogan as this, in terms that no one who listened to him would understand, as this sort of I don't know, rabble raiser, and sort of described him like a shock jock, almost like a shock jock of the 1990s, which is
and like a conspiracy theorist too. It was strange stuff. Yeah,
and like, you know, sort of just completely ignored the fact that that, you know, he did have the now president and the vice president and the, you know, biggest I think he's the richest man in the world, right? Elon Musk on there repeatedly, along with other really quite sophisticated guys like Mark Andreessen and stuff, who are, you know, they're no, I mean, say what you will, that they're interesting, sophisticated people. But that's just sort of like an example of people in Australia putting their fingers in their ears and going, la, 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 right?
Yeah. It genuinely just depresses me when, like, this guy is, like, at the top of Australia's, like, state media. He clearly has no idea, you know, about anything, about, like, you know, one of the biggest podcasts in the world, dismisses him. I mean, and look, Joe Rogan even had like John Fetterman on. It's not like he's just a Republican, Alex Jones, schizo, conspiracy theory hour sort of thing. He's like, he's like the big guy, and nobody watches ABC anymore. It's like, dude, like, just come on, like, get better.
Anyway. Well, also, it just is a pure business proposition. The guy just has zero awareness about how substandard his current product offerings are, and zero real, like, zero awareness. You think you'd have a little bit of awareness about what else is, you know, interesting and successful in the media market. I mean, ABC Publishers has all sorts of different oddball trash which no one watches, that engages in conspiracy theories and all sorts of crazy stuff too. So it's just like, I don't know, I just thought it was like substandard management above anything.
It's just straight up shouldn't exist. It should become like a Greyhound racing 24-hour channel or something. Like, it's a waste of taxpayer dollars. It's doing more harm than good. It fails to prove its need for existence. Mom was telling me, like, back in the 70s, the ABC used to actually churn out really good content. Like, it would have good shows. It would actually make, like, good reality or interviews and things like that. But, yeah, now it's just complete trash. And I think I've seen, like, clips of podcasts of theirs only when people have been insulting them. And it's the same with, like, comedy shows from the ABC. Just horrific. Like, just give up. I mean, it's one of those, it's just like, just grim failed state TV. Where anyway,
they haven't got one successful podcast on their whole platform. No one watches their radio. Their radio, you know, ratings are in a complete dive. I can't tell you the last time I watched an ABC footage. Anyway, we can hate on the media for all we want. There have been other new guys tapping through and putting things online, notably Matt Barry, who gave a speech. Matt Barry, this tech entrepreneur from Australia, probably, you know, as close as we've got to an equivalent of an Elon Musk, although I don't think he's quite as loaded as Elon. But he gave a speech in the northern suburbs of Sydney to a Liberal Party branch. Yeah, I mean, it created a huge stir. It was incredibly data-driven. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. I mean, he's saying all the right stuff. And, you know, the point that really stuck out to me, and I think, you know, it doesn't get talked about enough, although, you know, we talk about it, is the impact of immigration on voting patterns and how that, you know, plays out in a democracy. And, you know, credit to him. I mean, he's a data guy and he showed the visualization of the data that immigration has on electorates and things like that. And from what I can see, it's almost like a one-to-one, you know, comparison between high foreign-born percentage areas and electorates and voting for Labor. And from like what scant data and you know, research there is on this, I mean, we sort of deduced this, you know, a couple of years ago, but he's really sort of painted the picture and he's an established guy too. So, I mean, that is absolutely damning and it's indefensible and absolutely, you know, it's hard for pro-migrationists to really sort of say that this is fine and good. I mean, it seems horrendously unfair if we are quite literally, in its most base terms, bringing in Labor voters, disproportionately Labor voters. But yeah, what did you think of the speech?
Well, it was really data-driven. He had some Irish guy crunch the numbers in the way that only tech guys can. And yeah, I mean, it's you can quibble probably at the edges of it. I mean, is it as deliberate from Labor as he claims, or is it just sort of a gradual expansion from those Labor areas into bluer seats? But yeah, I mean, in purely regardless of what you think about immigration in terms of economic growth and social cohesion and anything else, in purely electoral terms, it is suicidal for the Liberal Party to be supporting mass immigration because you just lose all your blue ribbon seats. You know, whether you think how quickly you think people can be turned from red to blue in their voting intentions, you know, it's about, I think he said, it's at least 60-70% of new migrants, new Australians, however you want to call them, will vote Labor. Now, as long as that sort of volume continues, you'll never get ahead of the wave unless you stop it. And, you know, I don't want to get into trouble, but, you know, Peter Dutton did a couple of months back say he was going to cut net migration a little bit, but literally yesterday said he wasn't going to cut it at all. Was that your reading of what he said?
It was a bit heavy from the ABC to sort of say that, but he did sort of signal that, like, they're going to announce it after the election or something like that. It was really strange. It's a strange backtrack from the Libs. I think what has happened is that they have they've realized that they might be able to win without talking about immigration, and that means that they can keep the business community on side, possibly keep multiple migrant groups on side as well by not talking about immigration. So yeah, it's, you know, obviously extremely disappointing from the Libs. They are still so far behind. I don't think they get it. And like you say, it's electoral suicide for them to keep pursuing this. I don't think they really care. I don't think they're thinking, you know, 8 years ahead, let alone, you know, 4 years ahead.
It's almost as though I always feel like these days the people talk like I keep saying to people that it's demography, not ideology. People want to talk in these as though it's a Oxford Union debate and you make your case and someone makes the other, as though whether tax rates should be higher or lower, or even the woke stuff. You know, it's crazy, and it probably does have a little bit of an electoral impact. I mean, Trump did run a little bit on that towards the end of his election campaign, but it wasn't the determining factor. It was immigration and trade and foreign policy to a certain extent, but certainly immigration. And there's just, well, someone, there's a long history of politicians saying that they're going to make changes to immigration or introduce sensible immigration policy or cut immigration and not backing it up. I mean, not only, you know, Albanese in the last election, who said, I think 160,000 net migration was too high, who wasn't going to... It wasn't going to mirror Scott Morrison's policy, but also overseas, right? Like you've had there was, in light of the whole, it's probably worth talking about that a little bit in the UK, because they have Kemi Badenoch, who's the new Tory leader, came out with a speech saying that we're going to stop mass migration to the UK. And then lo and behold, a couple of days later, the Labour Prime Minister Keith Starmer came out with stuff which you would be labelled crazy for saying previously, or was certainly a fringe position, where open borders wasn't, I think his line was open borders immigration policy was not accidental, it was a deliberate policy in the UK government. So I mean, you would think, and then Justin Trudeau as well, right? The Canadian leader, he came out similarly with saying, bringing in, I don't know, I haven't dived into it in probably as much detail as I should, but it's cutting down significantly on the numbers of people that are allowed to come to Canada each year. And yet we've just not, all these sort of like countries or broadly like-minded countries, and there's been no, I just don't compute. Do people listening to Kim Williams ABC and not sort of and not registering? Because it's what explains it? I'm genuinely at a loss. The only explanation I can give is that if you were only watching, reading the mainstream broadsheets or watching the ABC, you wouldn't probably have heard of that, because it probably didn't get that much press in the airtime or ABC, and if you're just watching that, it probably is are oblivious to it all.
Well, a couple of things. I think I really don't think that Trudeau or Starmer or Badenoch even are serious about cutting immigration. They are all just saying it. I mean, like you said about Albo, it's before the election, he literally blatantly said that he was going to cut immigration once he got in, because we can't rely on overseas workers. Yeah. He lifted it to the highest number ever, and it's now like 1.4 million migrants. So he just straight up lied, and they can do that. I mean, I'm not gonna believe or listen to any politicians until they actually do anything. Like, what happened with Trudeau and Starmer is they saw their polling, which was absolutely atrocious, and you know they just jawboned immigration until they, which is what the Liberals did. They jawboned immigration. Until they sort of like got ahead in the polls, they said the few occasional sort of manipulated right-wing things about deportations for criminals or whatever, and then they edged ahead, people started liking him, and now nothing will happen. So I mean, I spoke to Daisy Cousins on last Friday, and I sort of said, politics today, it's increasingly blatant that they'll very simply just say one thing to another. It's the argument on immigration in Australia has been won. Like there's no more exploration needed to be done. It's clearly hurting more than it's helping. Majority of Australians want it cut. A lot of people want it drastically cut. So it's been won, but the government is just like, no, don't care, not talking about it. So it's like, okay, if the argument's been won, nothing's changing. The government are just saying that they're going to do something, but not actually doing anything about it. Okay, so then what is the next step? And it's like, you'd need to play like a 30-year political game to actually affect any real change. Like you'd need people to get into politics, you'd need people to get into the media, you need people to get into the institutions. You would need your own movement. And it sounds a bit cheesy when like Australians say this, but you do need like a sort of MAGA-like movement, I think, if you're going to get serious about actually fixing anything. Because right now, all that's happening is our elites are just like yeah, we'll do this, we'll do this, not doing anything, and it gets worse, sort of thing. So it's like, right, get the bull by the horns, get involved. It's a 30-year game, but you're going to have to play it, sort of thing.
And there needs to be a kind of single-minded focus on this issue above everything else, because occasionally it bubbles up in the Australian press, but then there's always some distraction which comes along. And sometimes it's a legitimate distraction. Like we did have, you know, laws recently which on media disinformation, which didn't pass, although I think it might be coming back in a different guise, the social media ban for under 16s. And in a way, I care about them, those issues. They are kind of important. But in a way, they're sort of second-order stuff, because it's immigration and then everything else, right? Because there's no point having a social media ban if you're having, if you're completely transforming your suburbs through mass immigration. And yeah, like you, if you've been focusing on this stuff for a while, there are trigger words. If anyone says like comprehensive immigration reform, it's just like, oh, you know, clearly that's just a complete, you know, lie. Unless it's like firm commitment to numbers with limited loopholes and a smart enough person that knows all the ways the scammers will try to sort of get through whatever legislation you put through, it's not going to be successful. I don't actually even think that I'm not convinced the guys in federal parliament even really know why the numbers have gone off the roofs, out of the roof so much. They just sort of like, they've designed this policy and then the numbers came through and they can't quite, you know, they can't, in some ways can't quite work out how to stop it. It's just, anyway, it's just like second order issues, everything else. But you know, if we want to talk about them, what did you think of that under 16 ban, you know, for social media users?
Oh, I agree. I mean, they are distractions. They're like dead cat on the table sort of thing, right? It's like, we'll talk about this bizarre ban that nobody wanted, everybody doesn't care about or hates, and then we'll just soak up all of parliamentary time. It's what are they called? It's like wrestling, right? It looks like it's fighting, but it's really just completely fake. Like, that suits the quote unquote regime. I mean, nothing of any substance is actually achieved. All the argument, it looks like there's a lot of argument, but it's actually not. I mean, I'm clearly against the social media ban or misinformation, disinformation. But I just don't care. Like you said, I mean,
not as much, right? Like, it's not like
It's completely, you're right, it's completely second order. It doesn't matter. I really do think, like, just assessing all of that, just assessing that the zero impact that Trump's victory had on politics here today, I reckon that we're genuinely just going to have like an 8-year at least political winter, no matter who wins, where it's just going to be a continuity of the same thing. And continuity of the same thing is just going to be destructive. I mean, NDIS is out of control, right? Like tens of billions of dollars and just absolutely getting rorted and no hope whatsoever of getting that. The housing crisis is like pushing police and emergency service workers out of the city. So like now the thin blue line keeping control of things is getting thinner and thinner. Immigration is just rapidly changing suburbs and culture. And politics, it's going to be this, but accelerated for 8 years. I'm extremely bearish, to be honest. I think after that there'll be something, but yeah, for the next 8 years, I don't know. What do you think? What's your read of the years ahead?
Well, I think our kind of luck has run out a little bit in Australia, because we had those glory years with the mining boom where we were exceptional compared to the rest of the world. You know, we still are in terms of assets, I think one of the richest countries in the world. But the latest economics stats which came out show that, I think McKinsey called us an economic problem child, per capita recession for the last 6 or 8 quarters, whatever it is. Government spending through the NDIS and everything else, basically responsible for I'm going to say the lion's share, but it's even more than that. It's more like 80% of the new jobs in Australia. And that's like directly rather than, you know, indirectly. So I read some tweet the other day saying, look, it's either, it's 4%. We have a low, you know, at least nominally speaking, a low unemployment rate. but it's all propped up with state-funded jobs. So if you took away the NDIS, you'd probably have a 10%. That's what the tweet was saying, the 10% unemployment rate with massive welfare benefits required to sort of house people. So now you've got, instead, you've got a 4%, you know, in theory, a 4 or 5% unemployment rate, but all these people working for sort of NDIS jobs, which they shouldn't be working for. So my thinking is, you know, our luck has kind of run out a bit. We were able to avoid it because of the mining boom and other things, but now it's just like the budgetary and immigration and other pressures are flowing through, and I don't feel like anyone's got an obvious solution. There's carping on the sidelines. Oh, you know, you shouldn't be spending as much, but no real like sort of root and branches analysis about what needs to change in our business model to you know, reorient the economy and the country in a different direction. I mean, the big headline, one of the big headline things which sort of filtered across to Australia was Elon Musk's idea of, you know, DOGE, the Department of Office of Government Efficiency or whatever it else. And people got a bit excited about that in the Australian stuff. And, it needs to happen. There's huge amounts of waste and stuff. Well, what did you make of that? I mean, again, it's a second order issue, so I can't get as excited about it. But it is kind of interesting, those tech guys bringing their kind of cost-cutting and efficient sort of business model analysis to the federal government.
Yeah, I think that's the like one of the few sort of things that I really agree with libertarians on. I do think that the libertarian like weapon or tool of obliterating sclerotic over bureaucratic government is like, you know, something that NatCons can really embrace, right? Because if like, you know, NatCons, let's just hypothetically say, take power and, you know, have this massive administrative state working against it, well, you're still sort of fucked, right? Like you're still, you're completely beholden to them. So, I mean, it's the only way. I mean, I think it was like Curtis Yarvin or something said, what did he call it? I can't remember, like schedule F or something like that. You're next schedule F, and you basically just send people around to the houses of federal employees across the country with a check saying, you've done a great job. Thank you for your service. You're fired now, and here's your payout and all the best. And that's probably it would be like what Elon did with Twitter. He cut 80% of the staff. It's running just as well. It's doing better. That I agree with like the libertarian instinct to completely cut and dismantle stuff like that. I cannot see that happening in Australia for a long time. Unfortunately.
This is probably getting too deep into the weeds, but you know, Trump's mentioned this, right? Back in the day, prior to the income tax being brought in, we had high tariffs and no income taxes in the United States. Okay. To me, that's a much more preferable sort of scenario, much more a nation first sort of approach. But at the moment in Australia, we've created a situation, what I call like the red zone, where if you jump inside Australia, the red zone, you're taxed to death, you know, public spending crushes you. All the incentives are to get outside the red zone. Once you're outside the red zone, you can import stuff in duty free. So we've created like this repressive environment for business activity inside this zone. Whereas in the past, it was like there were disincentives if you wanted to ship stuff outside Australia and because you'd have to pay big import tariffs to sell it to people inside our country. So it's all the incentives are wrong. And people laud the kind of Hawke, Keating, Howard, you know, 80s is this period of liberalization reform. We've had like mass, yes, the tariffs were cut, but we had, since that time, we've had capital gains tax, fringe benefits tax, GST, all sorts of super taxes, green taxes, either explicit or indirect, a mountain of regulation which is built up. It's almost like, and I'm not, but it's almost as though like the system is it encourages, you know, a hate on like your domestic worker. It's like, are you domestic worker or your domestic population? You're just so, you know, substandard compared to these bright, you know, intelligent, you know, imported people, or else people who are smart building things offshore? Why can't you silly Aussies be more productive? Whip, whip, whip. Or we need to have to regulate you more, tax you more. And it just doesn't, the whole policy settings are anti, you know, they're anti-Australian production formation, yeah. Business activity. Yeah. And it, that's one of the things that just needs, I mean, it's a massive change, but it just needs to, it needs to happen, because otherwise we don't produce anything and we become like this nation of warring tribes with no real coherent sense of national identity. And it's a grim, yeah, I agree. But
what a happy end of the year podcast. Yeah. That's
it. Well, you got to identify the problem before you change it, right?
Yeah, that's right. I agree that. I think I'm only now just realizing, because, you know, leaving school, you can't, you know, I just went and worked mostly just like on salary and wages. But now that I sort of do some contract work, run my own business officially, sort of thing, seeing the tax differences, it's like, oh, yeah, why would anybody work? For wages, like the sheer amount of taxes involved are astounding, and the amount of money, like lots of people that I speak to literally and quite seriously considering, like, oh, America's looking pretty good at the moment, right? Like low taxes, probably like politics and life will improve if you can get into a good area. The housing market is actually better than Australia's.
Surprise.
Like, Yeah, and it's like Australia feels, and it's increasingly becoming like one of those European states where everything is highly regulated, highly taxed. Nothing is really built here, nothing really produced. There's very little innovation. It's kind of just like a life of continuity, right? And that's such a shame, because Australia used to be, you know, we used to feel like that we could, you know, in the 80s and whatnot, that we could sort of punch above our weight, you know. We weren't really European, we weren't really American, we were a special third thing. It just feels like we're going down this like grey, dreary, commie block sort of like path, which is just, you know
it's depressing. I mean, we've got beaches instead of great cathedrals, right? But essentially it's sort of, it feels increasingly like a European economy where tourists cruise around and prop up the joint, and they know it's a place to visit but not a place to actually come and do business. It's just insane. I mean, there have been other changes. Oh, well, speaking of great cathedrals, there was the commemoration of the rebuilding of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, which is on paper, you know, it looks, it's, the French can sort of do classy things when they put their mind to it, at least in events. What did you make of that? I mean, Trump attended, all these world leaders attended, you know, for an opening, reopening of a cathedral. It's sort of interesting, right?
Yeah, I didn't know that that was, I actually couldn't figure out why they were over in France, but that explains it. it was because of that. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. No major feelings. I'm glad even France can still rebuild. Maybe there's hope yet. Generally, maybe it's a metaphor. I mean, I saw photos from the inside, and it kind of has that grayscale sort of new modern look to the interior. I don't know how much I love that, but it's fine. But, I mean, good for France, I guess. I don't know.
At some level, there was a pull to sort of like support Western civilization, and they all came from afar, even though they were precisely different reasons. And I mean, speaking of one thing which is dominating the headlines here, has been this synagogue attack in Melbourne, and I think it was an old, very old synagogue, well attended, 4 o'clock in the morning, firebombed. And there's been in the press, it's all, the attitude in The Australian and other papers has been, look, Albo isn't doing enough. He's not saying enough. He's not doing enough. And my attitude is almost like, and I went through all the articles in The Australian last weekend. There was no mention of immigration. And it's like, unless you actually tackle that as an issue, I think you've written about it before when there was protests regarding things going on in Lebanon. There's no point like making a strong statement. I call it like almost right-wing virtue signaling, because if you're not going to actually tackle the problem, well, it's just like, great, you're against it. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't like Senegal has been bombed, I don't like anything being bombed, but it, and it's not going to be solved with a stronger statement from Mr. Albanese. What do you reckon?
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. It's kind of coming in at the bottom of the funnel sort of thing. It's like, okay, the problem started up here with immigration. But we're going to, instead of actually addressing the real cause, which will require difficult conversations, instead we're going to put all the excessive resources on persecuting the very bottom of the funnel, and which will effectively mean that nothing will change, which is extremely strange. I mean, I would have thought the amount of interest in fixing this problem, the amount of effort and money and lobbying that goes into fixing problems like this, like increasing anti-Semitism or, you know, these protesters in Melbourne and stuff like that, I would think that people would genuinely want to change it. And having like one-to-one conversations with people, you know, in those communities that are affected or like politically aligned, they do want serious action, but it just never, ever, nothing ever translates into actually fixing it. Which is why I'm like, nothing will ever happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's almost as though, like, where did this thing come from? Where did these, you know, ethnic disputes come from? It's like, they sort of seem to present it as though, like, the universities are teaching bad stuff or you know, and maybe the universities, no doubt, are teaching bad stuff, but I don't believe that's the reason why they're, you know, it's clearly to do with demographic change. And the reason why Labor MPs are changing their tune when probably, you know, in the past they probably were supporters of Israel, God knows what, but they just changed their tunes because the electorate's changed. And if you really want to stop it, you have to stop that demographic change, dudes. It's like, it's sort of like so obvious, but something that they just cannot seem to confront.
Yeah, but Dominic Cummings, I don't know if you saw this, I've just seen clips of it. Dominic Cummings kind of came out recently and he sort of said, politics today is basically just a charade. All of the decisions are made before, you know, they even reach the politicians who actually sort of make the decisions, inverted commas. And it kind of does feel that way. It feels like a pantomime that politicians go and just say things, but nothing ever actually changes. And there's no real serious reform committed to by these people. Until that dynamic. I mean, like, you know, I worked for briefly in New South Wales Parliament, and like, if you overhear conversations between politicians, you know, they are just complaining, really, that like they actually don't have much of a say. The bureaucrats, the top bureaucrats, they sort of, in many ways, call the shots. And like Dominic Cummins was saying, it's like they would get scripted sort of meetings, like, because things were already decided. So there's no dynamism and no creativity in fixing things. So yeah, would you ever consider, just going back to it a bit, would you ever consider moving overseas? Because he lived overseas, right? Like Australia. Would you do it again?
It's tempting. The closest is Vanuatu, tax free, just across the 3 hours flight from Brisbane. So I have
not a bad idea.
Yeah. But look, I'm made my bed. I have to be here for a variety of different reasons. But look, I don't know. Like, there is a massive incentive to move offshore. There's a lot of, you know, podcasts and stuff based in Dubai. It's tax free. You know, it's not that, you know, there's a lot going on there in some ways. I'm not sure. The scene seems a bit sort of trashy to me, but each to their own. I'm sure you can find a good group of people. The States is where it's all just so dynamic at the moment. I just don't feel our media have truly picked up on it yet, Aussie media, there's not the slightest sense that they're at least excited by the changes over there. Like, at the very least, they'll report on it. Or there's never sort of any celebration. But, the Australian guys, Paul Kelly, the venerable Paul Kelly and Greg Sheridan, they still talk about, like, Trump being a threat to democracy. I mean, give me a break. It's bizarre, like, how out of kind of sync they are with with, and they don't understand new media. They're not on Twitter, are those guys. They're not really getting information from that source. You know, I mean, they're not getting anything from the source, and so they're just rehashing stuff, is my view.
I think whenever anybody says it's a threat to democracy, what they actually mean is it's a threat to me. It's just pure self-interest. And people like Paul Kelly and whatnot are completely right. Populism, you know, and the ABC, that Nick Bryant guy keeps talking about a threat to democracy. He's like a Fed or something. No, he's not. I'm just joking. But he keeps saying that Trump is a threat to them. And it's like, well, yeah, actually populism is a threat to you guys, because nobody actually cares really what you have to say anymore. They actually want much stronger solutions than classical liberalism and social democracy. So they want real reform, right? And yeah, so
yes, no, it's nuts. Well, maybe one thing we didn't talk about last time, which is sort of, it's not immigration, but it is demographic in a sense. I mean, the one group, well, one of the major groups that bucked the trend and didn't vote Republican was single women. So why do you think, like young men did, but why do you think there is this divide? I think it's not quite as pronounced in Australia as in the States from the data that I've seen. But why do you think that exists? And what can be done to bring, you know, to woo women, that section of women voters? Like,
are you asking me to understand women? Because
purely sort of voting analysis.
I think it's an extremely interesting opportunity or challenge for Republicans, because you're right, it historically has been something that
But liberals here as well, liberal party as well here. They have exactly the same issue voting. You know.
Yeah. how do I say this without sounding like I'm interested in human biodiversity or something like that? I think there are fundamental differences. The obvious conservative stance is that there's a fundamental difference between men and women, right? And that always comes up in the sort of transgender debate. And I think, you know, that's great. But that also has that leads to voting outcomes as well. Those fundamental differences. I mean, guys are protective of themselves and those around them and their countries. And like I tweeted kind of semi-jokingly, semi-seriously, like what kind of guy would want to bring more young men into be a threat?
Yeah,
or be
that
a
was
challenge
a really perceptive, really perceptive comment, because it goes to psychology. Like, you know, why would you?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, guys are always, you know, class has been closed off and, you know, inward looking, inward focused, whereas women are sort of a bit more open, and that's great. And that makes, you know, that sort of in a civil society, that means that, you know, we're all interacting and you know, we can have the life that we live now, which is good. But then when you sort of take that and it turns into this globalized aspect with effectively open borders, and you start applying openness to or liberalism, if you start liberalizing the borders, right, and you apply openness to immigration and stuff like that, then I think, yeah, also at a really fundamental level, like the women that I speak to like hate Trump because they think he's a creep or something like that. There's this like he's a philanderer and he, you know, has had multiple wives and has cheated and he's vulgar. And they have this like visceral reaction against them. Whereas guys are sort of like, yeah, Trump's based. He's like this big lion kind of guy. Yeah, it's an interesting psychological thing. I think like the Republican outfit or right wing outfit that ever sort of figures out how to sort of try and change that position, you know, we'll win. I don't know if it's possible, but yeah, we'll see. What do you think? Why do women vote?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there are differences between the sexes, and men tend to be more focusing on like protection and wariness of outsiders. Potentially, women are more open and empathetic potentially, and when that plays out on immigration policy, although you know it depends from cultures. Like in Europe, the youth vote is, including women, are very anti-immigrants, because who was telling me, basically, anyone who goes to France and spends a year there turns into a, you know, immigration restrictionist, because no matter how your politics beforehand, that's what happens to you as a young person. So there's that explanation. I mean, there is a big, it's not just, I mean, there's a marriage gap, right? Republicans still win the married women's vote, and the Liberal Party here still win the married women's vote, but it's the single women. God bless them, but they vote in a different way, and so they do react to the sort of vulgarity. I mean, it's some, like, he is a, unless, if he didn't have policies, he would be a boorish, you know, like, I mean, you know, braggart, and you know, not particularly in shape, and you know, sort of almost sitcom dad material. But worse. So it was a bit like, you know, what's the guy from Back to the Future, Hank, the one who beats up Marty McFly? He could be that kind of character, Donald Trump, in the right circumstances. So I kind of get it. But the I think the only, and what, you know, political strategists say is like, you know, we've got to sort of be more aesthetic appealing, and, you know, have the last lunches with Julie Bishop and Instagram them, and notice. And I don't know whether that is any evidence that that's effective in the slightest. And I think the only cause for hope is that since the Trump election, you've had, I don't know if you saw it, like Lana Del Rey, the singer, came out and she's talking about, because she went and married some, you know, macho dude from the bio, really. Like, he was a alligator. Yes, or something.
No, I've looked into this deeply, don't worry. Yeah. Like,
oh really? Yeah. And so basically, contrary to the sort of current position, I think the best hope is, like, you actually get these, you don't attract, opposites attract. So you get, if you're going to move these single women into the sort of married Trump voting corner, what you actually don't want is not sort of, I don't know, soy boy liberalism. You actually want that kind of alligator hunting dudes to become more prominent and lauded in society, because then the women, you know, like in dancing, you know, men lead and women follow, typically, with exceptions. And that, I think that's the only cause for hope. I mean, because you have had this like just whining kind of spokespeople for both the Liberal Party and the Republican Party who just, while they might, I mean, they're kind of pandering to women rather than actually sort of like offering them something. Anyway, I'm no expert in the sexes, but it's a purely electoral strategy. Clearly what they're doing at the moment is not working. And you've got to work out how to unscramble that egg, because that single woman as a percentage of the population are increasing in size. And, you know, they vote, and they vote a particular way, and it's really hard to... they vote, like, you know, 70% Democrats, and the population would be similar here in Australia. So unless you sort of like think of a solution for that, that's going to be an electoral problem for those trying to implement, you know, NatCon-y policies and whatever going forward.
I think one of the major insights that came out of the recent American election, you know, Trump didn't really pander to any group in particular, and yet he had the biggest swing towards them. And there was economic reasons for that. But I think, you know, the insight there, you know, Trump was talking about mass deportations, and then won, like, the, you know, did, you know, had major swings in the Latino vote towards him, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The insight there is, don't pander, lead. Explain why you're leading and why you're doing what you're doing. Whether that can be applied to single women voters, I'm not too sure. But I think pandering is a failed strategy. And just like, yeah, you're right. Like, it's kind of like this soy politics of pandering. But I think you do need a sort of more stronger
yeah, the nice
more confident position in yourselves.
The nice guy doesn't win. You know, you've got to win over the women's voters. I think it's just a flawed strategy. I think what's happened too, amongst the different policy changes in the US, tactically, it's shown that a different way is possible to greater electoral success. Like, for the last 25 years, as long as I've been around, they've always harped back to that Theresa May speech, the nasty party. Oh, we can't be the nasty party. She gave this speech way back in 2001 or thereabouts at this Tory conference. We're seen as the nasty party. And since that time, they've all tried to sort of like create this, oh, no, we're not nasty, we're happy. And, you know, we're sort of open and tolerant and we have diversity quotas and women and all the rest of it. And there's been little evidence really that that has had any, you might eke out a win here, like David Cameron got across the line in coalition with Lib Dems, or you just get across the line, but you don't have these sort of categorical wins like you know Boris Johnson did with Brexit. It was like in the post-Brexit election, it was campaigning on issues, and Trump just blew it out of the water because he almost went out of his way, even in campaign photos, where usually the advice is to have this smiley happy face. His photos were almost typically kind of like, you know, like serious mofo sort of photos. And it's just the opposite of what has been recommended tactically in the last 25 years has been shown to have more people want to vote on policy rather than actual issues. They couldn't care less whether you're a nice guy or a bandit, I think. So
yeah. Well, to speak positively about women,
we're trying to win them over. Well,
there's that great quote from Margaret Thatcher that I think about a lot, which is that, you know, politics is about conviction, not compromise. And I think that's completely true. You have your convictions, you make the argument, you stick to that. Politics by pandering, first of all, it's pathetic, and nobody likes anybody who's pathetic, which is why I think the Liberal Party is kind of worsening in its image and its brand, because it is trying to pander a lot. So especially while we're entering into sort of heady waters and troubling times, you don't want a weak weak leadership. You want the steady vessel to really guide you through. These are troubling times. Like, you know, rents are extremely high, cost of living extremely high, housing prices are extremely high. We have like ethnic conflicts now with like burnt synagogues and school buses getting set on fire. Like, it's increasingly, you know, getting worse. So where Peter Dutton has had the opportunity, he's the ex-cop from Queensland. He had the opportunity to be the strong man. He's I don't know what's happening. He's spending so much time in these circles. I don't know.
The media advisors will all tell him he needs to soften his image and become more personable. And this is in line for the last 25 years of failed stuff. And what they don't get is politics is not a public relations exercise. It's ultimately has to be a policy, a battle of ideas and battle of debate. So people don't want the kind of like, and also don't think that it's possible. Like, you're never going to win Peter Dutton to be like, you're not going to remake your image as something you're not. It comes across as insincere, especially, and that's, you know, all the stuff I've read says that, especially amongst the younger group, it's insincerity, which is just the absolute killer. Trying to make yourself out to be, I don't know, eating, like, what do you want to do to soften the image? Cooking at home and, you know, washing up the dishes driving kids. It's just like no one really cares. What are you actually going to do? Why would they care? You're living in housing in on the side of the street and your caravan park, and because there's no, you know, you can't, people can't afford rent. Why do I care that someone's a nicer guy than the other one? I mean, it doesn't.
Yeah, what's gonna and do this for- is, no, that's exactly right. This is also the most media savvy population ever, right? Like, kids are just brought up on social media. They're going to see right through disingenuous, you know, consultancy crafted politicians. They're, you know, they're looking for really genuine, authentic people, which is why, you know, people liked Trump, not just despite his faults, but because of them. He was a real genuine person, and he came off. He didn't sort of like butcher his language to try and come off as manufactured as possible. He literally just said what came to his mind, even if it was insane. And people liked that because it was at least authentic. It wasn't this crafted, nice manufactured sort of thing. So there's really something to be said, especially with young people, about just being authentic. Who'd have thought? Who'd have thought that?
I would say the longest, you know, the long form podcasts with Joe Rogan, now recognized as being very influential at sort of reaching young demographics and a whole lot of other people. And I don't actually think I've ever heard an Australian politician speak for 3 hours. And I'm not sure that they'll be interesting enough to pull it off for 3 hours about talking about different stuff, because it's all so set piecey. In fact, I was saying to a friend the other day, the only time I've ever heard a politician in Australia speak for 3 hours with questioning is during the Moira Deeming defamation suit in Victoria, where some of those Victorian MPs were put on the stand and asked. And, you know, you do get, over that long period of time, much better sense of their personalities.
Any good ones?
It did not reflect well on them, is my fear. Moira's great, but the current job guys, I have mixed. Well, I have strong feelings about which we shouldn't be aired. Anyway, man, I think that's been success. Like you know, there isn't. Have you heard of any politician? I mean, they have Kitchen Cabinet with Annabelle Crabb, where they go and like make a pasta or something, or cook up a steak. But that's just half an hour and you know, canned stuff. And you got to move beyond that sort of initial chat before you really get into something substantial and you start to see their character come through. And I haven't seen anything like that in Australia. And I'm not sure they could pull it off because they're not as interesting people as some of those people that they get on.
I know that. I reckon Jared Rennick could probably chat for 5 hours if you
wanted
to.
Yeah, that's true. Canavan could too. And there'd be some selected other ones with probably more interesting life stories you're not aware of if they were up for it. But, yeah, like this set piece, like it actually makes them vulnerable too. If you're just doing a quick set piece for like a canned speech for an hour, like, you know, whatever, a couple of minutes, a few questions, they're always, Jono's always going to want to just get a gotcha question. Whereas if you do like a 3 hour long form or something longer, it's something substantial. There's no sort of like, oh, he said this, you know, well, it's part of a longer speech and, you know, he was able to talk more about it more interestingly. It's actually, they've got to get in the mosh pit in a way. They've got to throw themselves out and not just sort of like be issuing press release side of things. So, oh, I made no gaffes. Yeah, but you made no gaffes, but great, you know, it got nothing. It didn't make any sort of splash in the consciousness. So.
I get like the occasional Peter Dutton TikTok in my news feed now, and it's just him sitting in his office talking to the camera, and I just immediately scroll past because I know that whatever, even if it's about immigration, I know that whatever it is, it's going to be manufactured. It's going to have like 17 consultants would have touched it. It'll be inauthentic. I just simply won't care. Like it is, yeah, you're right. There's a real value in getting to the, like what people really like rather than just this manufactured class. And I think like politicians that do more of that and come off as more authentic will really get a strong response. I was going to ask, so you started NatCon this year, right?
Yeah.
How did that go? What are your thoughts so far and what are your plans next year?
Well, we're out and proud. That's the first thing. It takes a while to stick your head above the parapet and make the arguments. There was nothing here previously. Look, we've got doing the podcast. We've had a really interesting range of guests. Probably, you know, a bit more highbrow than you'll get on other sections, but you know, longer form discussions. I think we're talking about issues. Like focused on talking about issues that other people aren't. Like there's a lot of shock jockey types or people trying to become conservative commentators out there that will chase every single issue. But who's talking about trade? Who's talking about, in a meaningful way? Who's talking about immigration like you are and others? I think that there is I mean, where else in the media landscape are people talking about these things in the way we are? So that's a positive. You've got to get out there and do it. Next year, look, I think we just gradually ramp it up, reach, you know, time permitting, reach out to a broader range of people through newsletters and the like. Then I probably shouldn't, there will be some sort of event, depending on probably after the federal election, but before, bring some whole lot of people together who probably are still under the radar. I think there's a large constituency out there that agree with NatCon issues, but some of them are too sort of, well, you know, there's some risk involved in putting yourself forward and talking about these things in a you know, broad way. I think it's useful. There is a much more bookish sort of critique of this whole thing and a reassessment about what liberalism and open borders liberalism has done to us over the last 30 plus years, which again I don't think exists in the current, you know, media landscape. So look, man, we'll just keep battling away at it. And I think there have been successes, you know, we and I think the good thing is that the issues are on our side. Like, it's not as though we're barking up the wrong tree and eventually we'll say, no, this is the reason why you guys are wrong on mass immigration. It's really good, Jordan, you know. All the stuff that you've been talking about, you know, not really. You kind of got it wrong there. Your analysis was wrong. Don't think that'd be the way it's going to pan out.
No, that's right. I mean, our major threat is simply that, you know, there's enough power and money and will to sort of stop what should naturally be occurring politically in Australia, right? There's a big enough bulwark from the power that is. But I was just thinking the other day, I mean, it is pretty amazing, though. And I do think it has that, you know, there has been a sort of shift a little bit more and more to sort of our thinking, but it is, even in a simple sense, it is pretty amazing that now Peter Dutton and the Liberal Party are coming out and saying immigration does need to be cut, whether it's serious or not. Who cares? But they're really saying it. And he's also linking, immigration to housing and how it affects young people. And I think, like, that's, like, to me, like, in a very broad sense, that does feel like a bit of a victory, just because it's, you know, something that when I started sort of writing and talking about it, absolutely very few politicians, if any, were talking about it. So not taking credit, but it's just like it does feel like, okay, great, that's a vindication of sorts that there is something to it.
Well, they're dipping their toes in the water. It's sort of, in some ways, yes, it's great, but it's also so obvious that this had to, something about these things that had to be done. And there's, you know, they still haven't really tackled the student visa rorts in any substantive way. So there's plenty more work to do. You've got to turn a big ship with these existing political parties. So I kind of am sympathetic at some level, but you've seen in the US what's possible. I think Mark Andreessen talked on that Joe Rogan podcast about an alternative timeline, what the world would have looked like if there hadn't been that change. And, you know, Australia is a follower in some ways, you know, of what's happening over there. We just haven't followed much yet, but I think inevitably once Trump is sworn in and his new cabinet is sworn in, we're just not going to be able to avoid it. He was joking. Trump was joking about Canada being the 52nd state of the US and making some pretty harsh comments about Mexico and other things. We haven't quite caught his eye or Elon's eye yet, but that day will probably come, and there'll be, you know, I'm not like pro Australian, but it's not as though you'll be able to avoid these discussions in due course. Like, there will need to be a rejigging of trade. There will need to be a foreign policy will adopt a much more restraint type position, because we're not going to get involved in Middle East, you know, forever wars anymore under the Trump guys. He's been quite clear on in the reaction to the Syria stuff. The immigration, you know, we're not going to be able to try to dump the way Malcolm Turnbull tried dump, you know, refugees from Manus Island on Nauru to, in the US. That's just not going to fly anymore. So, you know, we'll have to duck and weave. And still think in Australia, they're at a situation, the political class, where they haven't really recognised that the current policy settings are flawed, fundamentally flawed, and need. And so they haven't even moved on to the second stage, was, or how do we actually, what makes sense, and how do we restructure them in a meaningful way? But anyway, man, it's gonna be fun. I think there's lots of it's gonna be no shortage of stuff coming down the line, and hopefully with a federal election in Australia and a state election WA, but a federal election mainly, that these issues will be at the forefront, and let's just see how these people react, and hopefully we can put some pressure on them to do good things. Good stuff, man. I'll leave it to it, and we'll talk so in the new year.
That's good. Cheers, then. Have a good one.